page 131. This is the line pursued by the agitators' standard unity trick. They emphasize their being different from the outsider, but play down such differences within their own group and tend to level out distinctive qualities among themselves, with the exception of the hierarchical one. We are all in the same boat. Nobody should be better off. The snob, the intellectual, the pleasure seekers are always attacked. The undercurrent of malicious egalitarianism, of the brotherhood, of all compromising humiliation is a component of fascist propaganda and fascism itself. It found its symbol in Hitler's notorious command of the Eintopfgericht. The less they want the inherent social structure change, the more they prate about social justice, meaning that no member of the community of the people should indulge in individual pleasures. Repressive egalitarianism, instead of realization of true equality through the abolition of repression, is part and parcel of the fascist mentality and reflected in the agitators. If you only knew, device which promises the vindictive revelation of all sorts of forbidden pleasures enjoyed by others. Freud interprets this phenomenon in terms of the transformation of individuals into members of a psychological brotherhood. Their coherence is a reaction formation against their primary jealousy of each other, pressed into the service of group coherence. What appears later on in society in the shape of Gemeingeist, Esprit de Corps, group spirit, and so on, does not belie its derivation from what was originally envy. No one must want to put themselves forward. Everyone must be the same and have the same. Social justice means that we deny ourselves many things so that others may have to do without them as well. Or, what is the same thing, may not be able to ask for them. Footnote 33, text. It may be added that the ambivalence towards the brother has found a rather striking, ever-reoccurring expression in the agitator's technique. Freud and Rank have pointed out that in fairy tales, small animals such as bees and ants would be the brothers in the primal horde, just as in the same way in dream symbolism, insects or vermin signify brothers and sisters contemptuously considered as babies. Footnote 34. Text. Since the members of the in-group have supposedly succeeded in identifying themselves with one another by means of similar love for the same subject. Footnote 35. Text. They cannot admit this contempt for each other. Thus, it is expressed by completely negative cathexis of these low animals, fused with hatred against the outgroup and projected upon the latter. Page 132. Actually, it is one of the favorite devices of fascist agitators, examined in great detail by Leo Löwenthal, footnote 36, text. To compare outgroups, all foreigners and particularly refugees and Jews, with low animals and vermin. If we are entitled to assume a correspondence of fascist propagandist stimuli to the mechanism elaborated in Freud's group psychology, we have to ask ourselves the almost inevitable question. How did the fascist agitators, crude and semi-educated as they were, obtain knowledge of these mechanisms? Reference to the influence exercised by Hitler's Mein Kampf upon the American demagogues would not lead very far, since it seems impossible that Hitler's theoretical knowledge of group psychology went beyond the most trivial observations derived from a popularized Le Bon. Neither can it be maintained that Goebbels was a mastermind of propaganda and fully aware of the most advanced findings of modern depth psychology. Perusal of his speeches and selections from his recently published diaries give the impressions of a person shrewd enough to play the game of power politics, but utterly naive and superficial in regard to all social or psychological issues below the surface of its own catchword and newspaper editorials. The idea of the sophisticated and radical intellectual Goebbels is part of the devil's legend associated with his name and fostered by eager journalism, a legend, incidentally, which itself calls for psychoanalytic explanation. Goebbels himself thought in stereotypes and was completely under the spell of personalization. Thus, we have to seek for sources other than erudition for the much-advertised fascist command of psychological techniques of mass manipulation. The foremost source seemed to be the already mentioned basic identity of leader and follower, which circumscribes one of the aspects of identification. The leader can guess the psychological wants and needs of those susceptible to his propaganda because he resembles them psychologically, and it's distinguished from them by capacity to express without inhibitions what is latent in them rather than by any intrinsic superiority. The leaders are generally oral character types with a compulsion to speak incessantly and to befool the others. The famous spell they exercised over their followers seemed largely to depend on their orality. Language itself, devoid of its rational significance, functions in a magical way and further those archaic regressions which reduce individuals to members of crowds. Then this very quality of uninhibited but largely associative speech presupposes at least a temporary lack of ego control. It may well indicate weakness rather than strength. The fascist agitator's boasting of strength is indeed frequently accompanied by hints at such weakness, particularly when begging for monetary contribution, hints which, to be sure, are skillfully merged with the idea of strength itself. Page 133. In order successfully to meet the unconscious dispositions of his audience, the agitator, so to speak, simply turns his own unconscious outward. His particular character syndrome makes it possible for him to do exactly this, and experience has taught him consciously to exploit this faculty, to make rational use of his irrationality, similarly to the actor or a certain type of journalist who knows how to sell their innovations and sensitivity without knowing it. He is thus able to speak and act in accord with psychological theory for the simple reason that the psychological theory is true. All he has to do in order to make the psychology of his audience click is shrewdly to exploit his own psychology. The adequate of the agitator's device to the psychological basis of their aim is further enhanced by another factor. As we know, fascist agitation has by now come to be a profession, as it were, a livelihood. It had plenty of time to test the effectiveness of its various appeals, and through what might be called natural selection, only the most catchy ones have survived. Their effectiveness is itself a function of the psychology of the consumers. Through a process of freezing which can be observed throughout the techniques employed in modern mass culture, the surviving appeal have been standardized, similarly to the advertising slogans which prove to be most valuable in the promotion of business. This standardization, in turn, falls in line with stereotypical thinking, that is to say, with the stereopathy of those susceptible to this propaganda and their infantile wish for endless unaltered repetition. It is hard to predict whether the latter psychological disposition will prevent the agitator's standard devices from becoming blunt through excessive application. In National Socialist Germany, everybody used to make fun of certain propagandistic phrases such as blood and soil, Blut und Boden, jokingly called Blubo, or the concept of the Nordic race from which the parodistic verb aufnorden, to northernize, was derived. Nevertheless, these appeals do not seem to have lost their attractiveness. Rather, their very phoniness may have been relished cynically and sadistically as an index for the fact that power alone decided one's fate in the Third Reich, that is, power unhampered by rational objectivity. Furthermore, one may ask, why is the applied group psychology discussed here peculiar to fascism rather than to most other movements that seek mass support? Even the most casual comparison of fascist propaganda with that of liberal progressive parties will show this to be so. Page 134. Yet, neither Freud nor Le Bon envisaged such a distinction. They spoke of crowds such as similar to the conceptualization used by formal sociology without differentiating between the political aims of the group involved. As a matter of fact, both thought of traditional socialistic movements rather than of their opposite. Though it should be noted that the church and the army, for examples, chosen by Freud for the demonstration of this theory, are essentially conservative and hierarchical. Le Bon, on the other hand, is mainly concerned with non-organized, spontaneous, ephemeral crowds. Only an explicit theory of society, by far transcending the range of psychology, can fully answer the question raised here. We content ourselves with a few suggestions. First, the objective aims of fascisms are largely irrational in so far as they contradict the material interests of great numbers of those whom they try to embrace. Notwithstanding the pre-war boom of the first years of the Hitler regime, the continuous danger of war inherent in fascism spells destruction, and the masses are least preconsciously aware of it. Thus, fascism does not altogether speak the untruth when it refers to its own irrational powers. However fake the mythology which ideologically rationalizes the irrational may be, since it would be impossible for fascism to win the masses through rational arguments, its propaganda must necessarily be deflected from discursive thinking. It must be oriented psychologically and has to mobilize irrational, unconscious, regressive processes. This task is facilitated by the frame of mind of all those strata of the population who suffer from senseless frustrations and therefore develop a stunted irrational mentality. It may well be the secret of fascist propaganda that it simply takes men for what they are, the true children of today's standardized mass culture, largely robbed of autonomy and spontaneity, instead of setting goals, the realization of which would transcend the psychological status quo, no less than the social one. Fascist propaganda has only to reproduce the existent mentality for its own purposes. It need not induce a change, and the compulsive repetition, which is one of the foremost characteristics, will be at one with the necessity for this continuous reproduction. It relies absolutely on the total structure, as well as on each particular trait of the authoritarian character, which is itself the product of an internalization of the irrational aspects of modern society. Under the prevailing conditions, the irrationality of fascist propaganda becomes rational in the sense of instinctual economy. For if the status quo is taken for granted and petrified, a much greater effort is needed to see through it than to adjust to it and to obtain at least some gratification through identification.